1975. Senate Bill 583, 804, 806, 862, 863,
Okay. That will be second.
863.
Ladies and gentlemen, start this morning by Representative Grattan Cairns, who's going to testify on Senate Bill 583, and then out of turn, I'm going to ask Cecil Edwards from the Senate to come forward, and I will first go have Grattan Cairns. Representative Grattan Cairns before you. We'll put you on number two, because he has to dash.
I'd like to sit with him. I'm not going to take any time.
That's fine. Senator Wingard, since you both come from Eugene, I imagine this is an outstanding mill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But that's better luck with a field burning mill.
There's always a second day.
Well, I mean, I hope it has the same luck as a field burning mill.
For the record,
Mr. Chairman, my name is Grattan Cairns, State Representative, District 39 in Eugene. Senate Bill 583 revises the Oregon Motor Vehicle Liability Insurance Laws and is a particularly important measure to me because it seeks to remedy problems experienced by all Oregonians. I know of your concern and expertise with regard to modernizing our motor vehicle code. Specifically, you examined in this committee establishing an administrative adjudication system to replace the existing court system for handling traffic cases. And you prepared a revision of the rules of the road, those laws governing the conduct of drivers and pedestrians. So I'm particularly happy with the job that was done in that area. And it is my hope that you will consider Senate Bill 583 a suitable counterpart to that motor vehicle code revision, and that the committee will now weigh the need to look closely at our laws after an Oregonian has a traffic accident. The measure is entitled the Uniform Motor Vehicle Accident Reparation Act. It is an attempt to provide motor vehicle insurance coverage that would compensate the policyholder without regard to fault in an automobile accident. The accident reparation system that would be established by this legislation compensates the victim for his medical and economic loss directly by his own insurance company without regard to fault. Every owner of a motor vehicle will be required to have insurance protecting himself, his spouse, and children. We're talking about several key points and changes. First is mandatory insurance coverage. The second is payment for economic loss. The third is eliminating tort liability except in serious cases, the most serious cases. And four, providing for minimum liability coverage for damages arising out of bodily injury of $20,000. And four, a minimum liability for damages arising out of injury to or destruction of property of $10,000. Emphasize 2 points here. One, the right to sue in serious cases and have additional coverage that, if the driver wants, would provide for greater benefits and protections. And two, under this proposed no-fault plan, we remove obstacles currently existing by paying claims to the policyholder from his own insurer. If I can digress for just a minute, Mr. Chairman, that's really the key point we're going to be looking at in that bill. You're going to hear testimony, I hope, and I hope this, the industry takes this as a serious attempt at consideration of the problem and will come and tell you all of the reasons why not, as I can certainly tell you why. The key area is the tort liability question, the fact that one goes back to one's own insurer for his compensation, with reservation of the right to sue in serious cases. The point that has to be stressed is that under the present system, you have the right to sue, but you have absolutely no right to any recovery whatsoever. You can easily find yourself in a situation where you can have serious loss to your family, a death, dismemberment, permanent disability, and exercising your right to sue, do so, and lose, and have nothing after a long, drawn-out battle. You can, under our present system, enjoy the right to sue, and do so, and find that the person you were suing is judgment-proof, and get nothing. So all of the stories we will hear, if I'm not mistaken, we probably will, of this great and honorable, time-honored right to sue, I agree to. But at the same time, we must balance, on the other hand, the right of recovery. In cases where there is definable, obvious loss, where we can recover and eliminate, you know, the uncertainty of, you know, persons who are paralyzed or extremely smashed up in an automobile accident, go for years without ever any getting a nickel or any hope of getting a nickel. Okay, it would be irresponsible, I think, not to take note of the impact of this legislation. The automobile has become, for good or ill, a central part of our lives. Substantial changes in our methods of insuring them and compensating people for injury and damages resulting from car accidents are bound to have far-reaching economic and legal consequences. But we should look at the question of accident reparation. Senator Hart, United States Senator Hart, through a committee in the United States Senate, found that out of each dollar paid for insurance coverage, only 40 cents go to compensate accident victims. Hart found, on the other hand, that health insurance plans return about 95% of each premium dollar paid by the consumer. It seems to me that payments to persons injured should be made by their own insurers. It is also true that auto accident litigation absorbs up to one-fifth of our national judicial resources, adding again to the consumer's bill through his tax paid. It is my sincere hope that the committee will examine this proposal, Senate Bill 583, and will view it as an attempt to provide a better system of accident reparation. Most importantly, we must continually examine our insurance laws, as they profoundly affect every Oregonian, giving the 1,200,000 licensed drivers in this state who experience 80,000 reported accidents annually and who suffer thousands and thousands of injuries and hundreds of deaths in a system that is can be described in some respects as no more than Russian roulette after the fact of the accident. Each member has a booklet here. There's quite a lot of material here. I won't even begin to go through it, but it's only part of the research that my office has and will be sharing with your administrative assistant should you get into a very serious consideration of this bill in your work session and have need for it, and I'll send it on to him.
Grattan, if you could make available your comments, I appreciate they're general.
Yes, right.
And then just to speaking for myself, and I certainly can't speak for the committee, I feel very conservative about modifying rules of evidence, and I feel maybe very conservative in this area, because I know there have been so many thousands and thousands of words written on no-fault insurance, and there have been so many different plans, which probably, like the various remedies for the common cold, prove that really none of them are remedies. And so these are various insurance efforts to solve this very serious social problem probably all have deficiencies, and I would be more than happy to make a major effort to come up with the very best solution, taking advantage of the very best thinking on this problem. Whether I think this committee will have time is another thing. However, we have to start somewhere, and I would be happy to start with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you could provide us with a section-by-section analysis in some way, maybe the legislative council that helped you on that could do that. And we're in the law is being changed and some rationale for the change.
All right.
And I appreciate it as a big assignment, and it need not come this week or next week, but you know, sometime reasonably soon.
All right. Certainly.
Senator Carson? Senator Wingard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be very brief. This is a similar measure to one that Senator Brown and I sponsored in the last session. And I want to tell this committee that I did not do any work on this measure last session, that she simply asked me as a courtesy to be with her on the bill. She has done a lot of work on this measure, and when I asked her about what kind of shape this bill was in, she told me she thought she had the bill in very acceptable shape, and she would not mind if I introduced it, and Grant was interested in the bill also, so we co-sponsored this particular measure along with Mary Burroughs in the House. I am not an expert as you, Mr. Chairman, and therefore probably am not as conservative on this particular measure. You see, that's what happens to us here in the legislature. Those who really know what the present law is and how it's working probably tend to be more conservative because we think it's probably the best of several evils. I think also, though, it's like the person who knows it can't be done. He's the one that really is able to solve problems in engineering because he knows it can't be done.
Yes, I understand the mechanism.
I do think many times that we are blinded by the fact that we know how something works, so we think, well, sure, it's not the best, but it works. And I do hope the committee would look at this as innovative legislation. It did work on it last session, I understand, spent a good deal of time cleaning this legislation up. And I, as Grant mentioned, and I feel the same he does, that there is certainly something worthwhile in this bill. And I have done a section-by-section reading of the measure, and I'm sure you don't want to listen to that this morning. I think the best thing Grant and I can do is to get a comparative basis and come back to you and give that evidence as soon as possible to this committee. I only remind you some of the horror stories of the non-insured, and I think the mandatory insurance portion of this bill is the most important part of it. But I think we can come back with a comparative analysis for you, and that would be the best thing we could do for this committee if that has not already been done. John, has that been done as far as you know?
I'm not sure. I'll have to go back and look at past files.
Because if you had that done or some work done in that area, it would certainly help us getting that analysis. I appreciate your courtesy. Right.
I use the term conservative in the sense of cautious.
I knew you'd probably want to modify that a little bit.
The more you know about something, the more cautious you become, and that's. I'm always reminded about the story about the honeybee, that not being privy to the theories and practice of aerodynamics, did not realize that according to those theories and practices, he doesn't have the wingspan to really fly. And not being privy to that, he does not only flies, but makes a little honey every day. And our problem here is we sometimes know too much of this, and we're having difficulty flying. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
May I ask Cecil Edwards to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is Cecil Edwards. I'm Secretary of the Senate. I have authority from the President to be here. The bill I'm going to talk on, to a degree, affects Senate business. It's something of a housekeeping measure. It tightens up the penalties for tampering with...
What bill is this?
Excuse me, 863.
63.
Thank you, Senator.
By the way, Mr. Edwards, you always have our permission to come.
Thank you.
You don't have to ask. Just you got a blank check to come here and.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you.
Give us the dice of your advice.
The reason that I am here and probably is because I've attended two seminars on security of computer information. We find now that there's a great deal of, one might say, entrance into computer information, really for two counts. One is a very ultra-sophisticated vandalism, which we had an experience in Oregon here last year. I'll just, if I may, with your permission, read from this just a bit. During January of 1974, a Mr. Fellinger, employee of the Department of Higher Education, secured the DMV computer telephone number as well as the entry password from the Highway Commission. Equipped with this information, he completed access to the DMV computer system. The actual terminal or mini computer used by him was located at the Chancellor's office in the Department of Education in Corvallis. He did retrieve data but did not alter any data. He did proceed to stop the monitor and bring the DMV computer to a standstill. Prior to January 31st, the DMV computer philosophy was to give maximum control to each user agency. No security measures were in effect at the time except for two backup copies. With the request to support time-sharing option for user agencies, the DMV files became extremely vulnerable to destruction by other than DMV personnel. At the time of the unauthorized entry, through the time-sharing option on January 31st, the Highway Department had 5 Bell telephone terminals and 3 IBM typewriter terminals, which were using acoustical couplers for communication. This cost the state some money, and it caused the computer to be down one whole evening, which, of course, the cost per hour is pretty expensive. The important thing of it is the ease of entry and the fact that there was apparently no penalties. This Fellinger later passed out news releases, and I think it was very profitable. He ended up as an employee of Honeywell Computer System because of his sophistication. And what this does, it simply adds one small section to 4S164345, and includes tampers or interferes with property, it defines it, of another. It is not limited to damaging, destroying, or altering, or otherwise tampering, or interfering with any computer system. I don't think there should be any opposition to the bill, Mr. Chairman, and it does give a little greater handle on dealing with people who invade the computer systems, which is now widely practiced. Some firms and some states have had some very sorry experiences.
Mr. Edwards, who actually did the drafting of this bill?
This is Legislative Council bill.
And has it been evaluated by anyone from the Attorney General's office or by Mick Gillette, who is here?
I'm not aware that it has, except Legislative Council. There is another section in the ORS that treats on this point, but the conclusion was it wasn't adequate.
My concern is that from a standpoint of a prosecutor, this meets their muster. Sometimes that's not...
That's beyond my confidence, Chairman.
Okay, well, Mr. Gillette is here, and I'll ask him.
If the committee would like me to examine the bill and report to the committee by letter, I'll do so.
I would appreciate that, Mick.
That's 863?
863.
I will do that.
Senator Carson?
No, I have the same concern that, that we're broadening the definition of tampers or interferes, and I'm not satisfied that's the best way to get at it. It very well might be. I agree with what you're trying to get at.
I'm just talking primarily of the reason why we need something.
Yes.
And the goal is to precise language of the bill and not...
Fine. Thank you very much. Back to Senate Bill 5-8-3. Is Tom Bessonet here?
I would prefer to defer to the Insurance Commissioner for the time being, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I did not realize he was here because it wasn't signed up.
I'm here, Chairman, just for questions and answers on this bill. If I do short, early on I can.
Please.
Yeah, I'd like to.
And just for our records, John, would you have the, I'm not familiar with the Insurance Commissioner, so why do you recognize him?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Lester Rawls. I'm the Insurance Commissioner for the State of Oregon. And I have been involved quite extensively in no-fault legislation. Also including this particular bill. I won't mark for or against because I don't take that necessary position, except that in this particular bill, which is known as the Umbara, to my knowledge, this piece of legislation has not been enacted in any state in the United States. It's been considered by every state, really. However...
Excuse me, you use a word of art or a code term to describe this particular...
Umbara? Yes, it's Uniform Motor Vehicles Reparations Act.
Well, thank you.
The bill was developed several years ago by a group of commissioners, not insurance commissioners, designated, I believe, by the Uniform Legislation.
Uniform Commission on... Or the Commission on...
Uniform State Laws.
Yeah, that's it.
Uh-oh. You can rest your case, I think.
As a matter, we'll take judicial notice that there's no prejudgment on part of any member of this committee.
With the possible exception, we've unfunded Oregon's participation in
this. Well, as I say, this bill, as you can, if we could go all day particular bill, but it's many, many pages long. It's really not designed, as far as I'm concerned, for a state of our size. If we do not have the problems in the court system that this bill talks to, we don't have the problem in the reparation system that this bill talks to, we don't have the problem in the uninsured motorist that this bill speaks to. This bill was designed, as I say, by that group, and at the time when there was a great deal of emphasis placed on the problems in the heavily populated area, uninsured motorist areas, court congestions, and horror stories of 5 to 10 years wait, and so on and so forth. When I was in practice in Portland, the biggest difficulty was that in doing defense work, that we could get to court too soon. Plaintiff 4 to 6 months was average. You get there quicker if you wish to. The biggest difficulty was the defense not being able to get their case prepared and so forth. So we don't have those 5 or 6 years, and I think it's even better than that now. I don't really know what the rates are. But our particular bill has worked quite well, a particular no-fault bill or PIP bill, whatever you wish to call it in Oregon. I guess while I have the chair, I might speak to that because I think Senator Wingard or Representative Karen did make mention of it. The Oregon Bill is in Oregon, doing a great job. We have the only real problem we have is that we have a difficulty between the insurance company and the lawyer in the way he might be compensated if he's a plaintiff's lawyer becomes active in the case prior to the time that there's a transfer of funds between one insurance company to the other. But as to the insured, persons who are being compensated, I think they're in great shape. We do have an amendment into that bill this session, which will increase the medical payments up to $25,000. And 2 years statute on the medical pay instead of the 1 year. That may sound like a great amount, but quite frankly, the actuaries of all the companies advised me that from the $3,000 to $5,000 was an infinitesimal increase, and from the $5,000 to $25,000 was practically nil, because in an automobile injury case, beyond that, 99.6% of the time you're either below it or you're expired. But for that, those 0.4% of the people who do go above it, we felt we'd bring that in. So I say I could go on, but I don't wish to take a lot of time.
Senator Carson.
Commissioner, you probably have a greater background in this than anybody I know. Could you speak to the issue of the first bite theory in Oregon? Financial
responsibility.
And can we make a change? Should we make a change? Oregon has taken the attack over the last three sessions of speaking to the problem no fault speaks to, but problem by problem, rather than passing a uniform omnibus bill. And we've been trying to speak to the court delays, whatever it may be. One of the ones we have not spoken to is the one I've had difficulty explaining to people is why you have the first bite theory in Oregon.
Well, the states that enacted mandatory coverage, Carolinas, New York, Massachusetts, so forth, all still have a certain percentage of uninsured motorists. Because unless you go to the Arabic way of turning off the hands when a person is involved in an accident, I don't know of any way that you can force practically the people who are irresponsible to carry insurance. Now you can say, well, they'll have to get insurance when they get their license plate. But then they take they get their license plate, then they send their policy in for cancellation, goes to the insurance company, and the insurance company then takes a certain amount of time. Then that piece of paper then goes to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and then they send out another notice to the state police to go out and pick up the license, and it goes through that. And it takes 2 to 3 months to get that process through. And all during this time, the person's uninsured. You can't prevent the problem of the fellow who drives without a driver's license. Because every day in every court, there's many people in the state, there's a law that says you can't drive without a driver's license, and they still do.
Commissioner, I should add, however, that there have apparently been in the past deficiencies in the law. For example, we discovered here very recently that the judge, when he suspends the traffic, the driver's license, was precluded by the law from picking up the license. So very frequently these problems do exist, and in part they exist because of gaps in the law. Yesterday, before the Human Resources Committee, we had the case of the Mexican alien who was uninsured and paralyzed this girl here in Multnomah County. And I think the public is interested to what extent there are holes still in the law that might be closed, and if only 1% of these cases get these uninsured motorists off the road.
Well, Senator, I appreciate that. I and if there was some way, I would be the first to support any bill that would get them off the road. But I just, in reviewing all of these, I don't think in a practical sense we can, because as you mentioned, the alien Mexican driving in. Now, there's no way we can stop him unless we stop everybody at the border and then periodically stop him at the road. But to protect themselves,
we have another bill in which will increase, make it mandatory for the insurance company to provide increased limits of uninsured motorist, so that if I want to protect myself for against that person, then I can go to my own insurance company and say I want a higher limit of coverage to protect myself for the person who may hit me, because I know that there's going to be at least 10% of the people in Oregon driving those vehicles out there on the road, whether they be residents of this state or some other state or some other country, or whatever they might be, are going to be uninsured. Now that, unfortunately, that 10% causes about 40% of the major accidents.
Is there a law on the books in the state requiring that the evidence of insurability be in the glove compartment in the car?
No, not.
Would that be is that a possible suggestion?
There again, you can pass that law, but that person, that he doesn't care whether there's a law that says you have to have registration in the car, and there's one that says you have to have a license, driver's license in your pocket. But many people violate that every day because they don't have a driver's license, and because they've stolen the car or stolen the plates. And those are the type of people we're trying to get off the road, but they're just, I'm trying to be negative. I wished I could, because in my experience, not only in the private practice, but just in the insurance companies, there were these horror stories, and they were bad. But they're always this type of person who would injure somebody, and he didn't have a dime. He was judgment proof, he didn't have any insurance, and he didn't care. And they say the only, but I think that we ought to look to protecting ourselves as we do on our fire insurance and everything else, our hospitalization and so forth. And for my own part, buy the coverage that's available, so if that person does injure me, then I have that coverage available to me. Now, it's available in some companies on a voluntary basis, but our law will require all companies right in business in Oregon to make that coverage available at higher limits.
Of course, if this individual, the uninsured motorist, generates a good number of the traffic violations, you said 40%.
40% of the, that used to be a figure of the major ones. I don't know whether it's still.
If every time the policeman stops the motorist and asks to see the driver's license, could it add an addition to see the insurance policy? This might be a suggestion anyway. I just off the top of my head.
Well, but a few weeks ago I was in Washington, D.C. and had a little time before I met with one of our congressional delegates, and I walked across the street to the Supreme Court, and there happened to be a case being argued at that point where Border Patrol officer had stopped a suspicious-looking car up around San Clemente, and the question there was whether he could do that, and the argument was whether he was checking the driver's license and so forth, and I don't know how the outcome of that case, but the jurists are seem to appear that if you don't have any more interest in just to be able to check to see whether he's got a driver's license or something, you have no more other probable cause, you're not going to be stopping every car on the highway.
Well, I was assuming that there was a traffic violation. Incident to a.
And, but so often the traffic violation is coupled with when they're running down the street the wrong direction and hit somebody. And by that time, they act. I wish there was a way. I really do. I've looked at all of the bills and the theories and so forth. Someday somebody's going to come up with one.
Thank you. Sir Carson, sir. Thank you very much, Commissioner Rawls. On Senate Bill 583, Tom Bessonette, please.
Thank you, Senator Brown and Senators. I am Tom Bessonette. I'm the casualty claims manager for Oregon Mutual Insurance Company, headquartered in McMinnville, Oregon. I started adjusting insurance losses in 1950, so I have seen quite an evolutionary process in the claims business, and I must say that I appreciate the direction the industry and the legislature has thus far moved. However, I think Senate Bill 583 would be a step backwards, and I'll point that out as I go along in one generalized way. First off, it does not answer all the questions that the sponsors indicated it would. We will still have uninsured motorists driving in the state of Oregon, as has already been illustrated by the Insurance Commission. We will also have out-of-state tourists. who will not be able to comply with our law because they're unaware of it, and as a result, they will have accidents that will not be insured. It will not cover stolen vehicles, because there's no way that you can afford coverage for the stolen vehicle. Our current Oregon law does provide the uninsured motorist protection, which does provide reimbursement for our own policyholders if they are, in fact, innocent of fault in the accident. One of the greatest changes of the Oregon system was implemented in 1971 when the legislature enacted what we now consider our first-party benefits, or personal injury protection, PIP as we call it, or PIP, where it provides that no longer does the injured party, irrespective of fault, have to wait to collect his damages for loss of wages or loss of or for medical expenses until the outcome of a trial. He is now allowed to collect from his own insurance company and then continue his court action if he has one at a later date. This bill, 583, does take some of these rights of lawsuit away from him, because if he isn't injured too badly, he then can only collect from his own insurance company and foregoes any right of civil action against the wrongdoer. This shift is one that I seriously object to in relationship to responsibility. I think that the responsible party should be called upon to own up to his own responsibilities. In other words, the at-fault driver should have to pay the claim. If he can indemnify himself through an insurance policy, that's fine. His rates will soon reflect, however, his attitude of his responsibility to his brother in the street, and as a result of it, there will be individual responsibility continued under the Oregon system as it is. This law does not change, or the proposed law, 583, does not change the fact that the individual will have to carry liability and property damage insurance. I recall Senator Packwood, when he voted for the National No-Fault Program, writing to me and explaining his vote, and said that he was doing it in an attempt to save insurance premiums for the policyholders of the state of Oregon, and he cited how much premium they would save. And so I calculated that back on a basis of the individual policyholder, and in the metropolitan area of Portland, they would save approximately $2.40 per policy period, or 6 months. In the McMinnville area, they would save 50 cents a policy. And as a result of that, they would surrender their right to lawsuit or to sue somebody for wrongful acts, except in bad injuries. So I thought the savings was very minute, personally. In Oregon, the cost of liability insurance and our PIP program is not horribly expensive. Therefore, we're not talking about the horrendous premiums that they were charged for in Massachusetts or some of these other states that do now have mandatory insurance. I would point out to you that our system that we're working under now is not perfect. I cringe when an attorney tells me that I'm going to have to pay so much in defense fees, so I might just as well pay him a token amount in settlement. I cringe very strongly when I have that approach come to me, but that's not the fault of the system. That's the implementation of the system. The integrity of the attorney that's negotiating with me is a serious challenge as far as I'm concerned. However, that is certainly part of the fact of the system we now work under. I'd like to call your attention to just one part of this particular bill, and that's on page 34, section 43. It's called the low-weight vehicle. And it says, in effect, and I'm going to paraphrase it because it is rather lengthy and it's rather complicated, and it requires that the insurance commissioner implement some rules for adopting the low-weight vehicle or proportionate share of damages in page 34, section 43. It says, in effect, and I figured this out the last time we had the hearing over in the House side last session, that if a vehicle, say a farm vehicle loaded with bales of hay on it, was stopped at a stop sign and was rear-ended by a Volkswagen, that the insurance company for the truck would end up paying a major portion of all the damages to the Volkswagen who rear-ended it, as well as all the injuries to the passengers in the Volkswagen, because of the propensity, again I used that word, I used it last yesterday, because of propensity of the damage to the truck should have caused had he been moving. and been involved in is a lightweight vehicle. This is one of the reasons why I'm against the bill, is that there's no equity in it. This lightweight vehicle, I mean, it's geared for two moving vehicles, and when they crash together as a, this type or a broadside intersection, that the propensity to do damage is so much greater with a heavyweight vehicle that they say, okay, he should pay more for the damages. But notice that it does allow recovery between the insurance companies. The sponsor says it will eliminate court actions, but does it in fact eliminate court actions where we cannot come to an agreement? I still think that there's going to be a lot of problems with this bill if it was enacted, and therefore I hope that it does not become the law of the state of Oregon. I might also add in closing that one of the vice presidents of one of the major five insurance companies that deal in the area of liability insurance indicated that one of the side benefits of enactment of federal no-fault or the no-fault, the Embarra bill type legislation would be to drive the small insurance companies out of the market. Now that would in turn have a tendency to dry up the availability of insurance for the average person in the state of Oregon. And for that reason alone, I would suggest that the bill not be enacted.
Mr. Bassanet, you mentioned that you felt the system was not perfect that we have currently, and then you also said there are problems in implementation. Now, do you have any constructive suggestions of a statutory nature that, as you evaluate the system, might be beneficial? You need not.
Some of those are already moving forward in this part in this session, Senator Brown. And I'll be happy to share with you personally some of my
If
my
you
thoughts.
Could, I would appreciate it by memo or just orally.
Some of the bills that we're supporting in trying to improve the judicial system.
Senator Carson or Senator Smith?
Thank you.
Judge Smith, I have to testify over in House Revenue at 9 o'clock, and I thought if you would be so kind as to take the gavel, I'd appreciate that very much.
I hope you bring it back because I have to testify in highways soon thereafter, Mr. Chair.
Senator Carson, maybe we can split the difference and ask you to take the gavel.
Well, go ahead. Maybe John can do it.
We'll work it out.
Yeah, we'll work it out.
And here's the, there is Mr. Hawes from the Motor Vehicles Division.
Do you think you want passed out? And where are you going?
I think we... under the Smith rules of order, I think it won't have the court.
You're not too worried.
Thank you. I'll be back as soon as I can. The session's at 10.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, whoever that is. The effect of Senate Bill 583 on the Motor Vehicles Division would be to expand the present financial responsibility law to cover all resident drivers and vehicle owners. We would propose to administer this bill in much the same manner as we administer the present financial responsibility law. Under present law, drivers furnish proof of financial responsibility to the division by having their insurance companies file directly with the division a certificate of insurance known as a Form SR-22. This insurance certificate is not renewed each time the policy is renewed, but it remains in effect until the insurer notifies the division that the policy has been terminated. Notice of termination or cancellation is filed by the insurer on a cancellation form known as an SR-26. The division records pertinent information from the SR-22 and 26 forms on the driving records of the persons to whom they apply. In order to properly enforce the provisions of Section 41 of the bill, it would be necessary to record insurance data on the vehicle records maintained by the division as well. We estimate that insurance information would need to be maintained for approximately 1.7 million vehicles and 1.5 million drivers. Under the present financial responsibility law, the division maintains insurance data for 130,000 drivers. Based on our experiences with the present financial responsibility system, we believe that Senate Bill 583 would be very costly. Massive administrative changes would be required, including extensive reprogramming of the computer and large increases in the size of the workforce. We estimate operating costs approximately $2.1 million a year.
One potentially serious problem we anticipate with this bill is contained in Section 50. It says the driver or the owner of the vehicle shall file proof of insurance with the division prior to the registration of the vehicle. From our experience, it takes anywhere from 1 day to 2 weeks for a person to obtain the necessary papers from his insurance company to show proof of insurance. A possible solution to this problem would be to require the person, when registering his vehicle, to provide the division with the necessary insurance information. We would at a later date verify coverage directly with the insurance company on a given percentage of vehicles registered using a random sample. In addition to the fact that a person would be able to immediately register his vehicle, this type of system would be less expensive than the system proposed in this bill. Another approach to mandatory insurance that we feel is more cost beneficial is contained in House Bill 2694, which is currently before House Labor and Business Affairs Committee. The provisions of this bill require a motorist to carry and display on demand to a police officer as evidence of insurance cards issued by his insurance company. From the evidence we have available, this type of system is effective and relatively inexpensive to enforce.
Questions? Questions? I don't have a question.
No question.
Thank you. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 583? Senate Bill 804.
Have you seen a copy of the present birth certificate form?
No. Not for 40 years.
The proposed change in the law, existing law, is based on the fact that the unwed or, quote, illegitimate child at the present time is basically being discriminated against, and the mother of this particular child would possibly constitute a higher risk of communicable disease infection than that of perhaps a normal delivery performed in a hospital. With this in mind, we've suggested the change in the law be that the birth record be reported at the county with the local county registrar, which would be the health department, and instead of having it deferred directly to the state, because the local county health department were able to provide many things to the woman. When, first of all, we use it as an epidemiologic tool. The birth certificates are reviewed on a weekly basis, and specific things, health problems, potential health problems, are looked at, and if something is noticed that, you know, maybe justifiable in terms of contacting the mother or having a public health nurse go out and make contact with the woman, then this is done, and this is the basic purpose of having the birth certificate registered at the county. The law, as it was intended perhaps originally, was attempting to protect the woman in this situation from exposure to local authorities of the fact that she had an unwed or child out of wedlock. This, I think, is a changing moral value. Women's liberation is becoming more and more common. I believe more and more births out of wedlock are occurring. The father's name is not necessarily present on a birth certificate, or where the name of the father and the child differ, or where the woman is not married. So this is one of the basic changes that we're asking for. That is, we feel that this woman does constitute a higher risk in terms of venereal disease infection, and also is discriminatory not providing her the opportunity to receive information on immunizations for the child or free public health services that are available, well child clinics or postnatal counseling, which might be necessary, perhaps even more so with a woman who has or a child outside of wedlock. And it also gives her the option of, again, not having the record sent to the local registrar. She has the option to override it. This is the basic change we're asking for. As you can see, I've circled the items on the birth certificate that would be affected. At the present time, all records wherein the last name of the father and child differ, where the name of the father is missing, or the box down at the bottom, item 21, is checked the marital status. These records would be forwarded directly to the state, and there would be absolutely no screening or any record of it at the local county level, where it could be followed up by health personnel.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Just one. I think probably obvious, the other change is to allow anybody to complete the certificate. Now it says a physician or a midwife, and one of the changes is rather than anybody. What's the rationale behind that?
Okay, the feeling is that, and this is, I think, verified in the increased number of births that would qualify under this. For example, in Oregon last year, in 73, there were approximately 2,600 births which were qualified under the, you know, unmarried status. We're not reviewed at the local level, and perhaps a fairly high percentage of these were actually home deliveries or deliveries in other than a hospital setting, or other than by a nurse or physician. Therefore, allowing the parent or any witness of the birth to report it, I feel would perhaps enhance at least the reporting and recording of birth. At the present time, someone would be very, would be very discouraged in terms of even reporting a birth, just because of the fact that they were not, the delivery did not occur in a hospital setting.
Well, how does that follow? I don't argue with you, but are you saying that there's a feeling that when a child is not born in a hospital, there's some reason for hiding the fact of the birth? Or
this was, I feel, was probably the original intention of the bill. And by liberalizing, by allowing anyone to report the birth and be witness to the birth, at least anyone over 18 or a parent that was present at the time, it's encouraging the reporting of home deliveries or deliveries, you know, in perhaps commune situations.
What we're saying, if we put this in the law, is that somebody other than the parent and one of the parents has got to be there at the time of birth. If I remember my biology correctly. But saying that. It seemed to me that the physician or midwife would be done by just a matter of convenience to allow the one in attendance to do it. But to say to allow anybody to prepare the birth certificate, the thing I'm concerned about is the birth certificate is the first of many documents that actually control your life. And I think that goes to part of your other argument, and I agree with you, that it's very significant. But I'm just not certain why we ought to open it up to anybody to do it, prepare the certificate, but you've answered why you feel it's necessary.
It's it's really just being witness to the birth, actually, and not necessarily, you know, I don't think it takes a medical doctor or a nurse necessarily to fill out a birth certificate or to be able to at least answer the necessary information regarding the birth, and it would not affect any existing, you know, any existing procedures that now exist in recording of births in hospitals. That procedure would remain the same, obviously, because the physician and whoever's in attendance would keep them when they report it. But this would expand it to allow for situations other than, you know, the standard hospital setting, and possibly home deliveries or, again, and I think this sort of subculture, it does seem to be growing at least a slow rate, and that's kind of witnessed by the increased number of children being born out of wedlock.
Yeah, I don't know that being born out of wedlock and being born out of the hospital, there may be a relationship, but I don't think it's a direct relationship.
No, not necessarily.
Are you saying that your information leads you to believe that the mothers are either unable or unwilling to execute the birth certificate?
Well, obviously the mother would have, the opportunity to do it, saying one of the parents, mm-hmm. Which I don't think excludes, the mother from executing it as well. All it does is just define it being other than necessarily a medical person.
Or a midwife. Of course, a midwife presumes it's going to be outside of the hospital, although that's not necessarily, but... Okay, thank you.
The definition of a midwife, though, is I believe there's a legal definition, and it is someone who would be certified as such a midwife. The delivery could have been done actually by the husband or the other person involved.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Martin? Mrs. Martin, I'm sorry.
Chairman, I'm Marion Martin. I'm the State Registrar of Vital Statistics with the Health Division. And I am here in opposition to the Senate Bill 804. I believe that it does not contribute to good registration practices. Our primary objective is in getting birth records registered completely and accurately for the future use of the registrant and the family. In my opinion, this bill does not clearly place a responsibility for registration of the birth. It says that any person 18 years of age or older may register the birth. However, the fact is that 98% or better of all births in Oregon are attended by a licensed medical practitioner. And it is my belief that the legal responsibility for registration of the birth should be placed with the medical practitioner in attendance at the birth. And only if the birth is medically unattended by some other person. And I believe then that it should be by the person who actually delivers the child, such as a midwife. And there are some licensed midwives now coming into use, or by one of the parents. But the way this particular bill is written, it just leaves the whole thing up in the air. It says anybody that happens to be around, as I read it, can register the birth. And I think this is poor practice. In regard to the matter of filing the out-of-wedlock birth, here also, most of the births occurring to the unmarried mother occur in a hospital with a medical attendant. The out-of-wedlock birth and the birth occurring outside of a hospital are in no way synonymous. I would say, again, probably 95% of the out-of-wedlock births occur in a hospital and with medical attendance. And there is provision under the law for serology to be taken on the mother for the control of the venereal disease. So we are talking here about a very small number of births that may be out of wedlock and may also occur outside of a hospital. But basically, this bill provides that the mother makes the decision as to where the birth shall be registered, whether it shall be registered with a local registrar in the local health department, or whether it shall go directly to the state health division. And I believe that this is putting the mother in a position of making a decision in a matter in which she has no knowledge as to the implications of these various methods of filing the record. She doesn't know what it means, basically, whether this record will be filed with the local health department or come to the health division. Now, the original law was designed to give a matter of protection and confidentiality to the mother of the unwed, or the birth occurring out of wedlock. And while I think that there are some changing social attitudes in regard to out-of-wedlock birth, I believe that there are still many situations in which the mother would prefer that this not be a matter of local information. And I think this is particularly true in areas of the state, perhaps other than Portland and Multnomah County, which the urban area perhaps has somewhat different attitudes in this matter. But this, of course, will apply statewide. I believe that there are other ways of providing the medical care or the attention to the mother rather than tying it to the birth certificate. And in my opinion, this bill will weaken the registration process.
Thank you very much. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 7804? Go to Senate Bill 806. Mr. Lee Master.
Chairman, I'm Lloyd LeMaster. I'm appearing for Senate Bill 806. I think it might be useful if I give the members of the committee something to look at. I have been, as I have said in the first letter to chairperson, giving much of my time to the senior citizens at the Senior Citizen Center in Corvallis, helping with their legal problems and their tax problems. And I've been hit by an avalanche the past year of senior citizens retiring into Corvallis from other states. And they have protested loud and long that we have no law that permits them to put their furniture and things, as they usually say it, in the joint name so as to avoid probate. They've consulted lawyers around the state and they've been told, well, we don't have that kind of law. You'll have to make a will, you'll have to make a trust, and so on. I proceeded to write to a number of secretaries of state and secure their law in respect to joint survivorship. And I have, in my first letter to the chairperson, chair lady, I submitted the law of the state of Washington, which is the second page of what I've handed you here. And I've also received from many other states their statute law on the subject of joint tenancy or joint survivorship. This particular page of the Washington statutes that I've submitted here describes in one paragraph joint tenancy, personal property, and real property, so forth, how it's created and why. And it makes, it expressly states that the property or the estate created may be alienated by either of the co-tenants. Severance is the word that describes that to lawyers. Now, at common law, to create a joint tenancy, you had to combine the act with the four unities. You had to respect the four unities: time, title, interest, and possession. And we have a statute passed in Oregon, Section 93-108. I just xeroxed a copy out of the our statute. It says, every conveyance or devise of land or interest therein made to two or more persons other than executors or trustees as such creates a tenancy in common unless it is expressly declared in the conveyance or devise that the grantees or devisees take the lands as joint tenants, period. Now another legislature came along and said joint tenancy is abolished, and persons having an undivided interest in real property are to be deemed and considered tenants in common. Now, we're all lawyers here at the table. I think we're all familiar with Erickson versus Erickson, which back in 1941 said, in spite of this statute that says a joint tenancy is abolished, it's possible to create a survivorship by appropriate words in the deed. And those words used in that deed were on the wrong page in my notes. The words used in that deed were to the two persons, not as tenants in common, but with the right of survivorship. So we knew from Erickson versus Erickson we could still do it with respect to real estate. And we knew that as a result of the decision of 1941. Now in 1959, in the perhaps better known case of Halleck versus Halleck, opinion written by President Justice O'Connell, he spelled it out and told us what we had. This case held that joint tenancy cannot be created in Oregon, citing this 93-108 section, URS, held secondly that one of the incidents of common law joint tenancy long since abolished in Oregon is the power of any co-tenant to sever the joint estate by grant. It cannot be severed now, because what we have in Oregon respect to real estate is vested concurrent life estates with indestructible contingent remainders. Now, no place have we ever had any holding that this could be done by agreement with respect to chattel personalty. In fact, in this case, it expressly says, we express no opinion as to whether the right of survivorship in personal property as distinguished from realty may be created by express words. And there's a good deal of contradictory legal opinion being sold in Oregon, some to the effect, very little to the effect, but some to the effect that with the right kind of words and enough of them, you can create a contract between husband and wife in which the chattel personality may pass to the survivor without probate. But I find no case law to that effect, no statutory law to that effect. And in the last session of the legislature, there was a new section added, ORS. Section 93-280, and it says any person or persons owning real property which he or they have power to convey may convey such property by a conveyance naming himself or themselves and another person or persons, or one or more of themselves and another person or persons as grantees. The conveyance shall have the same effect as if a conveyance from a stranger who owned the property to the person named as grantees. Now, this section was put into the last legislature to make it unnecessary to go through a straw man or straw person if you wanted to create a joint survivorship. And again, you notice that nothing is said about personal property. It's real property, real property. I wrote a letter, my first letter, to the chairman of this committee, sending along this provision or page of the Oregon law, Washington law. And it was answered on February 5th, saying, forward your letter to legislative council with the request that they draft legislation according to your request. It will be submitted to the legislature, and when hearings are scheduled, I hope you will be able to be here to testify. If you are able to notify and supply additional witnesses, please do so. Now, I wrote back on the 24th, wondering how we were proceeding, and saying I'd be happy to respond, and sending along, to whom it may concern, a statement here signed by 16 people who represent different organizations in Benton County who favor this legislation. Martin H. Baker, Sr., president of the Senior Citizens Council of Corvallis, is here in person today. Mabel Mack was coming, but she just got out of the hospital 2 days ago and was hardly able to make it today. She represents the Grange. I indicate there that there's some 3,500 people that we're speaking for. I attended later, and this is the last two pages, a meeting of Chapter 97 of the Oregon State Employees Association, Corvallis, all of whom are retired employees of Oregon State University. And they endorsed this program and indicated after their name, this Xerox copy is in their own hand, indicated after their name the position that they held when they retired. I wish to make it very clear that you can look this over. You know many of these people in the state. Everyone knows several of them. And at this meeting, we were addressed by Lester B. Strickler, who is the present president of Oregon State Employees Association, and he signed this to indicate that he delivered the address. It was not on this particular subject. I thought this material would indicate to you something of the interest in this statute. Now, what was submitted was what we have here in the bill. This is simply what was submitted by legislative counsel. And I want to point out that what they have in Washington and all of the other states I've checked 21, is a statutory joint tenancy covering both real and personal property. But every one of them have extended the common law privilege of the right to sever. Under Oregon law, we cannot sever. This bill, as drawn or proposed here, every conveyance of personal property or an interest therein made to two or more persons other than executors or trustees as such, creates a tenancy in common unless it is expressly declared in the instrument of conveyance that the interest created is a joint tenancy. Now, under Halleck versus Halleck, we know that what we have in Oregon is not a joint tenancy, but is simply concurrent life estates with an indestructible remainder, which means that no co-tenant can sever.
Mr. Lipmaster, do you want to change this language? Is it all right as far as you're concerned?
What I would prefer, sir, is the enactment of a statute exactly like the Washington statute, repealing.
I think we understand
what we have presently.
All right. I think we understand that.
And in other words, I certainly think it's desirable that they have the right to sever. And I want to make it very clear, there's a lot of interest in this that does not concern just senior citizens, a lot of other citizens. This would give us an additional tool with which every lawyer could practice law to meet the requirements or the desires of his client.
Are there questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Lemaster.
Okay.
Appreciate you being here. Do you want to testify on this bill? Anyone else on Senate Bill 806? All right, we'll go to Senate Bill 862. Is there anyone here to speak in favor of this bill? All right, Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Michael Hall. I'm the court administrator for Multnomah County Circuit Court. I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 862. The present method for selecting jurors is via the voter registration list, which is a computerized list in Multnomah County. We have a computerized program which goes in and selects off, for example, we just made our annual run of 20,000 names. From that 20,000, we send out subpoenas monthly, which is again a random select off of that main database. To expand our requirement to use the utility customer list, the property tax rolls, the motor vehicle driver's license, vehicle registration list, and state personnel income tax would be quite cumbersome. We've done just a initial analysis, and the voter registration list, obviously, we are currently using. Utility customer list, we've talked to PG&E and PP&L and the Public Utility Commission. There is a problem in that the customer list is not kept by county. It's only by name. Many times you'll find your utility billing is coming to occupant rather than in the individual's name. It'd be quite cumbersome to go in and try to identify by county. You'd have to have some sort of identifier with your PP&L and your PGE. This might present a problem to them. It certainly present a problem to us. Property tax rolls. The property tax rolls. Again, they are not. They are not associated with the address. The. The motor vehicle driver's license and registration list, again, are not associated with the address for the individual, and the department indicates there might be a cost of about $13,000 in providing that information. On your state personal income tax rolls, you have the problem of confidentiality, which is one that will present a real problem to us in getting that type of data. What I would suggest, if it is the intent to expand the database from which jurors are selected, that perhaps the voter registration list and one of these, which could be determined by the county, could be utilized. In our instance, the property tax rolls and whatnot we have up on the computer, therefore we could interface with two lists using the voter registration list and the property tax rolls. I just think you're putting a tremendous burden on the counties, both cost-wise. In our case, where we do select a database of 20,000, we would have to almost go back to a manual system. You've got the age problem on your motor vehicle license, where you have people who are at 16 getting a driver's license. Obviously, they're ineligible to serve on jury duty. Also, you'd have the duplication. Depending on how you are in these various lists, if your name happens to have the middle initial on one list and not on the other list, you are then counted as two individuals. You could be receiving duplicate subpoenas. Also, then we would run into a problem perhaps not having adequate jurors. From an administrative standpoint, we see many problems trying to implement this bill. I guess from philosophical, if it's the purpose is to expand the database from which you select jurors, it has some merit. But administrative-wise, it'd be quite a task to try to work with.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the chairman isn't here. Members of the committee, I'm Ted DeLuz, Chief Tax Counsel, Department of Justice, representing the Department of Revenue.
Mr. DeLuz, the chairman is here.
Oh, excuse me.
I have to say that maybe by any chance.
I have copies of a letter here which Mr. John Lobdell, Director of the Department of Revenue, sent to Chairperson Elizabeth Brown. And I don't know whether she has distributed any copies to you, but here are copies for your perusal. And I'm going to just mention, I'm not going to read this, but in looking at this, our first comment is, and we're only concerned with the phrase state personal income tax roll, there is no such document as such. If this bill were to pass and we were to conclude that this, number one, gave the authority to county clerks to get lists of personal people who have filed income tax returns from their counties, it could be done because the Oregon return does require that a person list his county of residence. The cost would be well in excess of $3,000. It would, as Mr. Lobdell points out, severely overextend the demands on computer time already. Passing over the question of whether such lists would be of great value to county clerks, especially in the larger counties, our most serious consideration is with respect to the confidentiality provisions of ORS 314, 835, and 840. These statutes presently prohibit the divulgence of any particular from any income tax return or report required under the income tax laws. And we have taken the position that we cannot give even the name and address of any person making inquiry as to whether a certain person, let's say the person has the name of somebody, wants the address, and he wants it off the income tax return. We refuse to give that. And we do get inquiries as to whether John Jones or some other person has filed a return. For various reasons, people in divorce suits, and many people for personal reasons want to know if somebody filed a return. Perhaps they have a neighbor that they want to report on, or all kinds of reasons. But we refuse, even though the statute does not specifically say so, we refuse to give that information out. Even though technically if somebody does not file a return, we're not divulging a particular from a return if we say that they haven't filed a return. Nevertheless, it's an indirect way of finding out that they didn't file or did file. So we have taken the position under our regulations that we will not say whether the person did or did not file. And that confidentiality has been jealously guarded by the legislature. And of course, this would make virtually public lists of all people who file income tax returns in a particular county. As I say, we have some question as to whether or not the list would have be of great value to the counties in view of the statutory requirement that they're selecting names of the most competent and permanent citizens. I don't know what the relationship is there. Rather intangible, I would say. But we would request and suggest that this provision as to state personal income tax rolls be deleted. If for some reason the committee wanted to be in, then we would like to come back and perhaps give other wording to it and perhaps provide specific confidentiality provisions. That's it.
Thank you. Questions? Anyone else on Senate Bill 62? Now we'll turn to Senate Bill 931. Any Pence?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of you. I'm a GRASP student from North Salem High School, and I've been working for Senator Brown, working with John DeWinter for about, I would say, 5 or 6 weeks. And in the past 3 weeks or so, I've been researching into this bill on pretrial diversion. Now, if you don't already know, pretrial diversion basically means that if a person fits certain eligibility qualifications set up by a court, they will be allowed to participate in a program whereby their trial procedure is eliminated and they are put into a program of community service, rehabilitation, or education. Now, you might wonder what the need for a bill like this is if a person is charged with a crime. But as you probably well know, being a part of the Judiciary Committee, a lot of cases, criminal cases, are not cases involving hardened criminals. On page 3 of my testimony, which is in your, I think you have it, there's a piece of paper with a graph on the front of it and another with a set of statistics and facts having to do with pretrial diversion. On page 3 of the one with the fact sheet, that's the face page, I've listed some of the cases where a piece of legislation like this might be needed. Included in these are such things as the case of a welfare mother arrested for shoplifting food from a supermarket, and she claims that she's trying to feed her family. She certainly wouldn't be considered a hardened criminal. Consider the case of a reputable Portland doctor charged with public indecency. This man has a relatively large practice. He's considered reputable by the community he lives in, and naturally he's worried about his job, his reputation, and his family. Another example might be that of the youth of 19 who's arrested for minor in possession of alcohol, and he must be tried in adult court. This might be his first offense, but still, he's liable to get a sentence of up to a year in jail. These cases have all been recorded. There's also the case of this Pat Green, who lost control of his Volkswagen, jumped a curb, narrowly missed two policemen's wives, and was hauled in for dangerous driving and assault and battery, when in particular all he did was lose control of his car. Most of these cases, there's several of them that I didn't put in here, and in your second piece of testimony that I have, I've included newspaper articles from the National Observer and from the Christian Science Monitor that contain other cases for consideration when thinking about this piece of legislation. Pretrial diversion has been done in various parts of the country. If you look at your fact sheet, you'll see quite a number of cities have taken in effect this program and put it to use and found it to be successful. In Portland, Oregon, it's been used as an after-trial diversion program, and in a few limited cases as pretrial diversion. The fact of the matter is, the only reason that the Portland program hasn't been used as pretrial diversion is that, as now, Oregon has no statute that allows a judge to use this program as pretrial diversion. There's no statute that allows him to do that, and that's what this piece of legislation is all about.
So you can see the number of agencies participating in that program went from 15 to 260 in 22 months. They have an 80% success rate in that program. The amount of recidivism is reduced by half. In almost all programs of pretrial diversion, there is also, in your second packet of testimony, second page from the end, some statistics taken from the congressional record where they're also trying to implement this program on a federal level, showing statistics from 13 programs around the country, their rate of recidivism, their rate of success for the people entering this program. Some of the types of things that can be done with this program is that in the case of the doctor, he was ordered to set up a clinic on the Skid Row of Portland, Oregon. He served 40 hours, they usually recommend up to 80 hours of volunteer service time in a community agency. He served 40 hours and enjoyed his work so much that he continued the clinic. The young boy who was arrested for possession of marijuana was also a case. He was assigned to a boys' club, and after he had finished his work there, he found a more meaningful turn to his life and decided to continue, and of course was very happy with what this program had done for him. The way the program works is that a district attorney and a probation agency must both decide that this particular person is eligible for pretrial diversion. Okay, some of the limitations are that it pertains only to first offenders, misdemeanor cases, and felonies which may be considered as misdemeanors for sentencing purposes by a judge. Okay, so this eliminates major felonies, such serious crimes, and habitual offenders of the law. They're trying to, under this legislation, get in the people who probably would not benefit from a prison sentence. Because as you probably know, our prison rehabilitation system does not work as well as we would like it to. We have up to a two-thirds recidivism rate in most of our prison inmates. And I think among my testimony in the second part, we have a control group listed. I think it's in here somewhere. Let's see. Okay, anyway, I think it's among those statistics. And it shows a comparative rate for the amount of recidivism with our prison inmates as compared to those in the pretrial diversion program. And naturally, you might say that this would be because the people in the diversion program have been chosen for their eligibility. But that's exactly the point that the diversion program makes. These people are not hardened criminals. They should be channeled back into society where they can do some good. They should be given some meaningful work to do, and they should see some value in it. In the majority of the cases, there just isn't any problem with these people working in an agency as you might think would happen. Also, the cost factor. The Department of Labor gave a report to the National Subcommittee on Penitentiaries working for their Judiciary Committee and said that the cost would be reduced quite a bit. On the front page of my Senate Bill 931 fact sheet, it says that it would cost approximately $1,000 for diversion as compared to $1,500 for prison. Of course, this doesn't include the amount of welfare money or social services that must be provided to a prison inmate's family or loss of his tax revenue, which could still be paid by a diversion candidate. Now, in that case, if you consider that, the cost would be reduced even more. Now, as it works in Portland, they use only one coordinator for the entire program, and the probation cases that would otherwise have to go through the court system and go through the probation agency are simply gone through the probation agency as diversion cases. And so the existing probation agency could handle these cases, and it reduces the amount of space being used in the jail system so that you can put more serious offenders in there. The community also gains this free volunteer service. Many cases they don't have enough volunteers to carry out their social work and that type of thing. And so this really fills a need in the community. If you look down also in the middle of my fact sheet, you'll find several supporters of this type of program. Among them, the American Bar Association,
National District Attorneys Association, League of Cities, Organization of, there's an Organization of National Association of Pretrial Service Agencies, which provides professional help for people who wish to start this type of a program in a city or a state level. Also pertaining to this bill, I think it's important to note that it's being considered for implementation on a federal level, and they have done considerable research into this program, found it very successful, and would really like to go ahead on this. They're doing it under the Community Services and Supervision Act in their Judiciary Committee, and I've looked at those reports, and I find almost nothing but favorable testimony. This program has worked very well throughout the country. It's received national attention, and I think that there's just, you know, so many beneficial things that could come from a program of this sort. And you have to look at it and consider all things that the probation will waive speedy trial. The probation agency has the diversion candidate waive his right to a speedy trial, but the probation program will last no more than a year. Now, this has been a concern on a national level that the right to a speedy trial would be violated.
I think we've read your testimony at this point. If you have any additional points to make, we'd be happy to hear them.
Okay. I would like to draw your attention to the graph that's on the front page of the second part of the testimony, and like you to look at it and just see the amount of pretrial diversion cases that have gone up and gone past the referrals for traditional probation. So as you can see, in the program in Portland, at least, this has become very important to them as far as judicial proceedings. It's gone above and beyond traditional probation. So you can see it's quite successful and being used on a large basis. Any questions?
Excellent. Very fine, in-depth job, by the way. Wally, questions?
No, it's fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Gillette?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Michael Gillette, Solicitor General. I'm appearing this morning not on behalf of my usual client, the District Attorneys Association, which takes no position on this matter, but I do appear for Attorney General Johnson, for myself, and for Jim Hennings, who's Director of the Metropolitan Public Defenders Association, all of us in opposition. We understand also that Jake Tanzer has sent written material to you opposing the matter. We think it's unconstitutional, flatly. I've indicated to the committee previously with respect to one of Senator Smith's proposed amendments to SB 1 why this carrot and stick business is a violation of the Constitution, and I think this is a good example of why. In fact, the example given of the doctor being required to perform the 40 hours a week clinic service comes awfully close to violating Article 1, Section 34 of the Oregon Constitution, which makes slavery involuntary servitude improper. Judicial imprimatur or not, as provided by Section 4, there is insufficient judicial and due process safeguards in this procedure to assure that the thing doesn't become a kangaroo operation. And on the whole, however well motivated it is, and I certainly can't question the motivation that's involved, you just can't do that, I don't think. Beyond that, I want to make some very quick points about it on almost a line-by-line basis. First, virtually anyone who would qualify for this program would not go to jail anyway. That's one point to keep in mind, and therefore they would end up being subject to the same social service agency after trial they would have been subject to beforehand. It would be rare for any of these people to go to jail. Secondly, with regard to Section 1, the provision is the probation agency is the agency involved under the accusatory instrument. That includes in the State Division of Parole and Probation with respect to charges of Class C felonies, and that means that this bill has physical impact, although I don't know how much of one. And I don't know if there's a prior referral to Ways and Means. It's a question of business of the Senate. Section 2, I pointed out the problem with respect to Section 2, except that note the line, and the defendant has not previously been convicted of a crime. That's not the same as saying that he's a first offender, because if he's gone through this process for a year and stayed out of trouble and he's off the hook and then he gets back into it again, he's still not been convicted of a crime, but he's no longer a first offender, and that's not the way the bill's drawn. Moving to Section 3, the agency shall make an investigation and take into consideration and so on. The agency apparently is supposed to make some recommendation about the program the offender would go into. What about, for instance, repayment? in the case of theft or damage to property and so on. That, again, comes close to involuntary servitude. It would be a significant amount of money and what amounts to a judgment imposed without proper judicial sanction or safeguard. I'm not satisfied with the court simply endorsing without much of an opportunity to really know what's going on, an agreement made between a harried public defender on the one hand and a very busy prosecutor on the other, thinking, gosh, we've got a chance to get one out of the system, so that I think Section 4 is inadequate. I noticed, too, that the district attorney can refuse to let the person enter the program. There's no indication as to whether he can refuse with respect to whether or not, well, there's an indication that he cannot refuse based upon the judge's decision as to what program. Well, the DA's decision as to let the guy into the program at all has to be based, in many instances, on whether or not a particular program will be followed. If he has no control over that, then he's simply not going to agree. That's another problem. In Section 5, the provision that the individual comes out of the program if he's been arrested and convicted. Well, if we're only talking about a period of a year in which the person's in the program, the likelihood of his being arrested and convicted within the year is relatively small. It takes longer than that, even if he gets arrested 2 months after he started the program sometimes. So arrested ought to be enough to take him out. And I can go on and on, but it seems to me that the Constitution and other imperfections with this bill call for it to be defeated.
Questions? Thank you. Anyone else on Senate Bill 931? Go to Senate Bill 967. Mr. Leonard is here. Mr. Leonard.
I'll have to, Mr. Chairman, I'll have to apologize for not having an attorney here with me today, but this came. I was away, and the attorney apparently didn't get notice of the meeting.
Attorneys aren't always necessary, Mr. Leonard.
Well, no, but since we have attorneys here, maybe
only one. you can talk to me. I'll listen.
Okay. This Senate bill is almost a direct takeoff from about the same laws in about 20 different states. They're enacted because of the fact that they are mostly producers of raw materials. And they wanted to make it possible for industry in that to be competitive in their area. In other words, not to permit these selling in their states commodities at a lesser rate than the cost of production at the point they were produced, plus the freight. Now, the economists of the country have very recently have been, estimated that there's $100 billion taken from the American consumer by monopolies. Going back, maybe I'll go back. I'm a registered Republican. I went bull moose with Roosevelt on antitrust. I found out that Taft was a pretty doggone good man, and antitrust didn't get very far. Anyhow, I'm not prepared to make a full presentation. The immediate thing that I'm referring to is the difference in the price of cement in Oregon and the price of cement in California and Washington. In Oregon, we have locally one producer at Oswego. Permanente Cement Company out of Redwood City, California, have a price at Redwood City almost directly the same as the price in Portland. They ship to Portland at a cost, according to their own testimony at a freight rate hearing, of about $1 a barrel. But they absorb that dollar a barrel in order to meet the same price that the Oregon Portland Cement Company has. Well, now, Oregon Portland Cement Company are not appearing in this case because apparently there's somewhat of a mutual understanding as to what goes on. the effect of this bill would be that Furman Eddy's Rent Company would have to price in Portland the base, their base price at Furman Eddy plus freight. Now, I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't think that has hurt Furman Eddy. But I think it illustrates that there's a monopolistic situation. Now, California also gives the producers there of cement a 14% depletion allowance. That also gives them a favorable cost factor. The state of Washington, where we have competitors from Bellingham and two from Seattle, charge a manufacturer tax, or a tax that doesn't apply if they ship outside of the state. Now, many states have this, and it has been upheld as constitutional, in spite of at one time of a hearing on a similar bill, one of the opponents stated that it was unconstitutional. Well, that's about all I can give off the cuff, but I would like to submit later a summary of...
All right. That would be fine, either from yourself, Mr. London, or your attorney. Either one would be pleased to have that. Thank you very much for appearing. Mr. Flynn?
Morning, gentlemen. I actually didn't come here to discuss the bill as much as I did to obtain more information, and I was of the opinion that Senator Brown was going to be here to kind of help with a few questions. I don't know if the rest of you gentlemen know much more about the bill other than what is in my preprint here or not.
Our purpose is to hear you are signed up objecting to the bill. We're on tape. This is a formal hearing procedure. If you have something to say representing Payless Drug Stores, we're here to listen to you. The full committee will have a report not only from us, but from the record that you prepared. So it's your opportunity to testify on the bill.
Okay, I will continue then. Even though I'm not sure about some of the parts in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, not contradicting that, I share your concern. I'm not sure what they're getting at either, and that's one of the disadvantages of not having a proponent here to state it ahead of time. But I don't think Mr. DeWinter is in a position to plead the case for it. I've never seen the bill before, and I don't know what Mr.
Okay. Well, I would bring up some things that have hit me, and they may not be right when the bill is finalized, but apparently the gentleman ahead of me was concerned about one outlet and all, and I presume that this is for multiple retail outlets or wholesale outlets operating within the state of Oregon that would make it mandatory, other than for freight and other contingencies, that the retail price would be the same throughout the state. And I would ask if, even though an operator, whether they were wholesalers or retailers, had the same price throughout the state, would this preclude weekly specials on an item in any one area if it were not run in the entire state? I would also ask what the situation would be on the closeouts of any given item, whether it be an automobile, a garden rake, or a tube of toothpaste. Would one area be allowed to have a closeout on a commodity that had not done well in one area, and it might be a good item in another area? These are questions that I have not been able to find out. I would honestly think that the overall bill, if passed the way it reads right now, would increase the price to the consumer, because throughout the state on many, many items, because in the retail business, regardless of what it is, it has generally been a statement of fact that the more of any one commodity any dealer can sell or move, whether it be wholesale or retail, the lesser gross profit or gross markup is going to take on that item. It is the items that are not moving in great quantity that merchants, whatever they are, have to take a little bigger markup on. And no merchant or dealer can price all of his commodities at the lowest markup that is prevalent on his highest selling commodity. So I think that there would be a lot of revision to markup. I would take an example of a rig that they buy over on the coast to fish for salmon. Mooching rig. We sell a lot of those over in Coos Bay. Our markup is not too great. As you further come inland, we carry them in our stores, but by the time you get to the Le Grand, the sale is very limited. And I would grant that the markup is more than in Coos Bay.
Pardon me, Mr. Flynn.
Yes.
We have a session at 10 o'clock. I attempted to get us excused, but they don't have a quorum until we get down there.
Okay.
You see how important the minority party can be.
That's right.
Let's just stay up here. Maybe you'd be better off up here.
I'm worried it might be.
To stop you at this point and suggest that we will have another hearing on this bill to allow those who have not had a chance to testify as well as for you to finish your testimony.
Okay.
So we must excuse ourselves. You'll pardon us.
All right, gentlemen.